Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. Today is Tuesday, May 30th, 2017. I am John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary. With me, as always, Abe Greenwald, our senior editor. Hello, Abe Greenwald.
Hi, John Podhoretz.
And Noah Rothman, associate editor. Noah, how was your weekend?
It was lovely, thank you. We enjoyed ourselves. Didn't very little of anything.
There we go. We had a family wedding in Los Angeles, and it was a beautiful occasion. My sister Naomi has now married off her three children and is a very happy mother indeed, and we're all happy for her. And we're happy for you to join us at CommentaryMagazine.com, where we give you a few free reads and then ask you to pay $19.95 for a digital subscription or $29.95 for an all-access subscription that gets you our beautiful monthly magazine in your mailbox 11 times a year. Commentary Magazine, the 72-year-old monthly of intellectual probity, political analysis, cultural criticism from a conservative perspective. So we're going to start today by discussing Jared Kushner, the son-in-law extraordinaire, the dauphin-in-law of the Trump White House, the real estate heir, the husband of Ivanka, and the back-channel pursuer of a relationship with Russia that apparently involved his suggesting that this back channel take place through secure communications from the Russian embassy to Russia, thus cutting out any hope or possibility that the American intelligence agencies or parts of the American government would know what was going on in those conversations and provide a backdrop, supporting level of analysis for whatever was going on. Noah, you have, I believe, taken the position or sort of implicitly taken the position that people are wildly overreacting to the notion of the establishment of a back-channel relationship with Russia, and that possibly... skewing his face up so he doesn't like the way I am framing this.
I think that's fair. I'm just reflecting on my own position. Yeah, I do think that there has been some overreaction to it. Oh, not entirely. I think politically, Democrats are making a mistake by focusing entirely on the legitimacy and forthrightness of the administration's pursuit of back channels to the Kremlin. It's not unheard of. There are totally righteous reasons to have a back channel that can be very productive. Jared Kushner had a back channel that was to Beijing that was mediated by Henry Kissinger very publicly. The weird thing about this is, A, that it took place in private, given all the untoward circumstances around the Trump administration's relationship with Russia, and it followed a meeting with a representative from a Russian-sanctioned bank by the name of Veshekonobank. And that organization has channeled funds to the Trump organization through third-party intermediaries before. They have a very weird relationship, and it's something that they should have been more mindful of. But politically, immediately, right, dead center, is this revelation really could shatter the administration's trust internally, because it's once again another indication of Mike Pence being wrong and misleading the American public about the nature of Trump campaign communications with Russia. There were campaign communications not just with Mike Flynn, which, by the way, was why he was fired, supposedly, because he let the vice president lie about it, but because Jared Kushner was having these communications with Russia. And you can't tell me the president was out of that loop. I refuse to believe that. So that's what they should be hammering. And to see people like Dick Durbin say, I can't imagine why there would ever need to be a back channel, it just strikes me as they're losing the plot a little bit.
I'm not sure they're losing the plot. I think that for political, naked political reasons, the notion of establishing the idea that there is something untoward going on in which the Trump White House and the Trump family have improper relations with Russia and the Russian leadership and the Russian oligarchs who are in Vladimir Putin's pocket, that all of this creates a narrative that is helpful to them. It doesn't have to. It's not going to be the sort of thing that will tank the presidency or destroy Trump's numbers or anything like that. It just creates an impression. It's simple. It's easy to understand. Something's rotten there. We don't really know what it is. And it's got these two aspects to it, right? There's the foreign policy aspect, which is why are we cozying up to the Russians so much that we want to have communications with them that go through their own security system that is designed to exclude our own intelligence operation, right? So that's the foreign policy aspect. What do they have on us that makes us so eager to play footsie with them on their terms, that we would even suggest it that's part of the story, is that the Russians were astonished to hear Kushner suggest that this back channel conversation go on in Soviet channels. By the way, it is demented, because it's one thing to have a back channel, meaning that there's an individual who travels from one place to another having a private conversation that is deniable it's a he said, she said, and the Russians can say somebody said something, but he'll say they didn't and stuff like that. It's another to have conversations that are taking place through a Russian secure communications channel, meaning the Russians will have tape, the Russians will know everything that's being, the Russians will be able to dribble out information that is embarrassing to you if you don't handle it right. So that idea alone is a mark of some idiocy at the very least. But that's how I would say. Then you add the second aspect, which is the financial Trump family emolument problem, which is what you raised about the Russian bank. These connections between not only the Trump organization, but the Kushner family business, the Kushner companies, which is its separate real estate operation. And we know that...
Because he needed financing for that Fifth Avenue building.
For when
he
666, took yes. 666 Fifth Avenue, a building for which Jared Kushner decided he wanted to play in Manhattan rather than stick with the Kushner family's incredibly lucrative business in New Jersey, paid $1.8 billion for an office building that is now worth apparently about $700 million. So he has taken a huge bath. He has a whole idea about how to rebuild the building into some preposterous, like, Burj Khalifa of Manhattan with arches, and I mean, there's some architectural plan that's like some comic vision out of a James Bond movie.
He married into the right family.
He did. That's right. But you know, it's not just that, right? It's also that his sister Nicole Meyer went to China and then suggested that he would be buying influence with the Trump to invest with the Kushners. This is really bad. Now, she could have been gone rogue and done it on her own, and Kushner can. The whole point here is that the emoluments clause is real. The idea that it's not, the idea that a foreign government might be paying bribes to an American president if his real estate holding, since he hasn't divested himself of his holdings. That's a serious thing. That is an impeachable, that is literally an impeachable offense. It is in the Constitution as an impeachable offense.
Just to clarify my point real quick, yeah. And then I want Abe's take, is that I don't think that those are illegitimate issues at all. I do think that you can raise them and create this cloud of suspicion, but you can't prove them. What you can do right now is use this story to sow division within the administration and get people to talk about other people in the administration, fueling more leaks, fueling more irritation within the administration against itself, and thus, weakening its position.
I think the interesting thing is that with all these revelations, there's always two ways to look at the Trump administration. And one is that something very dark and sinister is going on. And the other is that this is just another example of gross incompetence and inexperience, and watching what happens when people who have absolutely no business doing what being in the positions that they're in, when they go about their job. But and there's also the possibility that there's some combination of the two in there. It still has to be said that nothing that the administration has done in the foreign policy sphere, no actual policies have yet bent to Putin's will. I mean, in fact, if Trump has now put Iran on notice to the extent that he seems to have done, That's where the rubber is going to hit the road because Putin is an ally.
However,
of Iran's.
Yeah. Remember that the exculpatory story that was in the New York Times after the revelation that there had been an effort to set up this back channel, the exculpatory story was the back channel was so that Mike Flynn, then the incoming national security advisor, since this conversation between Kushner and Kislyak, the Russian ambassador, took place in November or early December, was so that Flynn could have a serious come to Jesus conversation with the Russian general overseeing whatever Russia was doing in Syria. I guess in theory, so that they could figure out how to run a campaign to bomb the hell out of ISIS and bomb the oil and take the oil and bomb and destroy ISIS and all this without angering the Russians, which on the one hand is fine. It's a perfectly legitimate thing for them to have a private conversation about where their zones of influence might or might not be as a test or a feeling out or whatever. And on the other is weird because if the danger here is that Flynn was more compromised than Kushner knew and that he would be putting his finger on the scale in Russia's behest in the course of this conversation rather than serving the American national interest.
I think the Flynn component is slightly different. Obviously, it's very integrated into the
that
into
was
the
their
larger,
defense. Right, yeah, their right. Self-defense was that it was just so that Flynn could develop this relationship with the Russian general. But Flynn would have been the worst person, given all of this, absolutely, to be the person to be in this relationship with the Russian general, perhaps, since he got $500,000 from the Russian government he managed not to tell anybody about.
I would also add that the president took a very high-level meeting with two ranking Kremlin operatives, provided them with military intelligence of an operational nature. In the Oval Office, and that the White House does not dispute that a partial transcript of that communications included the president telling these Russian operatives that Comey's firing relieved some pressure on him to pursue bilateral relations with Russia that he otherwise couldn't pursue under that cloud of suspicion. So we're starting to look at some things that look quid pro quo-ish.
I have to say, as offensive as I find that and as maddening as that is, I could very plausibly look at that again as an example of some of incompetence and inexperience. That's what I would take it as.
I think it still is plausible that Trump, rather than being Don Corleone, you know, with having everybody dancing on the marionettes dancing on his puppets on his string, is more kind of just a bumbler, braggadocious bumbler. Now, maybe that there were people in his ambit, you know, like Flynn, like Paul Manafort, like Carter Page, like Roger Stone, who had more going on with the Russians than he knew or understood, and then in some weird, naive position, he sort of let them. In part because the view that he held of Russia and Putin and the way things ought to be done was something that could be exploited by people who were pro-Russia without him having to be doing this for naked political manipulation reasons or for economic motives, right?
I think there are certain sanctions that they wanted to lift, and I think most likely those sanctions were targeting VEB, Vernesh Econom Bank.
That's the bank that... Let's go through this again. So that's the bank that is giving the Trump Organization money through cutouts.
Right. It laundered it's a Russian government-owned bank. It's under sanction by the United States. And in 2004 through 2007, it helped finance a Trump Tower in Toronto through a third-party intermediary, but that money came from the Russian government. You have Trump family members who have routinely said that a lot of their financing comes from Russia, and they're not coy about it either.
They said it long ago, and they're coy about it now. They said it in 2008, 2009. I mean, Eric Trump said something like, "Well, you know, all we have to do is turn to the Russians, and we'll be fine."
Right.
That's not something he said since. But
so the Flynn Kislyak call was about sanctions relief.
That was the call that. There were five calls in a single day, right? Just to go back in this incredibly knotted story. Flynn said he'd had no communications with the Russian ambassador. It turned out that he had 5 calls in a single day with the Russian ambassador, and then he lied to the vice president about it. Anyway, the vice president Spicer then said this stuff hadn't happened, and it did. And so the idea was Flynn had to be fired because he had lost the confidence of the vice president by misleading him. Now, see, this is where it gets weird. So the calls to the Russian ambassador were about sanctions relief. But the only thing that happened, we did not grant sanctions relief to this bank. The only thing that we know that happened is arguably the only foreign policy success of the Trump term for 6 months thus far, 7 months, Trump and transition era Trump, which was the Russian decision not to retaliate after we kicked 35 diplomats out, after Obama kicked her, because of the evidence that Russia had interfered in the election, and Putin decided to forbear doing a tit-for-tat expulsion of Americans or some form of economic punishment of the United States, you have to say that's a success. That was a successful diplomat. Now, whether he did it because he was trying to curry favor, it was a gift to Trump coming in, it doesn't really matter. And yet the worst possible interpretation of that is the interpretation that has now become public, not because of fake news or anything like that, but because the Trump people act so guilty. All they do is act guilty. They're not walking around saying, look, we made sure that the Russians didn't actually retaliate against us for this thing that we did. Like, give us a little credit. They don't say that. It's not like it would take a lot of competence or experience to put out the good story instead of like raining the bad story down on everybody.
But, you know, paradoxically, that once again makes me think that there's sort of less there than meets the eye.
Because I agree.
Because if they were guilty, they wouldn't be so sloppy and so boastful and right. just
but
naked
they were
about
guilty.
It.
They lied about all this
stuff.
Well,
they stuff. Lied. Right, okay. Yes, however, yes. However, foreign policy, to be fair, foreign policy as it is being done is often accompanied by dissimulation, false narratives.
Well, look,
because you're testing out possibilities and you don't want to – you're testing out possibilities of where you might go in one direction or another and whether stuff can be done to settle things without public confrontation and all of that. But you don't want your fingerprints on it and you don't want to limit your options – in terms of response by giving away too much in the early discussion. So that's part
that's
and parcel
why back
of foreign
channels
policy.
Are perfectly legitimate.
Right, but you don't even need back channels. If we had more than 6 diplomats in the United States now, since we have 4 people in the State Department, including this bozo from Exxon who wanders around not, you know, giving press conferences to non-Americans and acting like he's doing us all a big favor by falling asleep on his plane and insulting Israel by saying that Tel Aviv is the home of Judaism. I mean, if we had more than 4 diplomats, we wouldn't need back channels, by the way, since the notion that we should presume that diplomats are somehow traitors to the United States is a pretty offensive one. However, I want to spin out a theory and have you react to it. Did this on Twitter the other day, which is, assume everything is totally innocent, okay? Let's try to figure out what Trump's mindset is. What do we know from the time that from June 16th, 2015, when he started running, he was worried that illegitimate measures would be taken to deny him the nomination and then the presidency. He said he wouldn't necessarily endorse the Republican candidate because he couldn't trust that the Republican Party, he wasn't going to make that predetermination because he couldn't trust that the Republican Party would be fair to him. He said, without a lack of justification, that the Cruz campaign in Iowa had played a dirty trick by announcing that Ben Carson was dropping out of the race, thus potentially suppressing a vote that might have gone to Trump. And which we know can't be dismissed because Ted Cruz fired the campaign manager after this bulletin went out saying this in Iowa. And then when Ted Cruz out-organized Trump in the South and won way more delegates than the percentage of the vote said he should have because he handled the rules of these primaries with more dexterity than Trump did, Trump said, they're trying to steal the election from me. And again, I don't think if you look at an election as simply a plebiscite where majority, where the person who wins the most vote should get everything, he wasn't entirely without justification. So the rule is, these are the rules, you play by the rules, you learn what the rules are. He didn't bother, but so, and then of course, then came Hillary. And he was worried that she would steal the election. He said he wouldn't necessarily abide by the results that, you know, might be stolen. And they were doing this and that and the other thing. And at some point in the course of this process, he becomes convinced, you know, who convinced him and how it happened internally, that the work, that the tools of the state were going to be deployed against him, that the FBI and the CIA were going to actively work to undermine the possibility of his election, right? So he gets paranoid. He starts saying he likes WikiLeaks for doing all this stuff because it's going to reveal things that the Democrats are, you know, they're playing games, they're trying to suppress Bernie Sanders' vote, and all they do, they don't care about votes, and they want illegals to vote, and da-da-da-da. Okay, so this is the Trump mindset, right? He summons upon himself the very thing that he most fears. He sets up back channels. He talks about the Russians. He says he likes the Russians. Mike Flynn, Manafort, these guys have playing footsie with the Russians. He's got Jared playing footsie with the Russians. And he attacks, openly attacks the intelligence community and the FBI and everything like that, right? So what happens? The thing that he feared was going to happen, the deep state, the intelligence, is now going after his jugular. It's leaking every day, leak the thing about Jared and Kislyak, leak this, you know, all this stuff is coming out from, you know, intercepted communications and stuff like that. So he, in innocence, this is the theory, some innocence, paranoid, as a paranoid, he summoned a paranoiac plot against him, and he's the only one to blame. Now, if criminal things are going on and he is basically not interested in figuring out that they're going on, he is implicitly involved in a cover-up. If he's going to Comey and say, stop investigating Mike Flynn, he is a good guy, that is potentially obstruction of justice, all of that. But he did it to himself. He summoned it into being by acting as though his race for the presidency was so dangerous to the establishment that it would do anything, move heaven and earth to get him. Whereas, in fact, it turned out the establishment was toothless and powerless. The Republican establishment folded to him without firing a shot. And Hillary Clinton sat there and bled herself dry for no reason because she didn't know what the hell she was doing and she had no reason to run for president. That is my theory. Gentlemen, react to my theory. Someone disagree with me because that's more interesting than agreeing with me.
Well, that sounds all right, with the exception of the fact that the idea, I suppose, that members of the intelligence community were animated by this. Well, I guess it kind of complements your idea. Where would Trump literally going to war with the intelligence community, calling them instruments of Nazi Germany totalitarianism, fit into this theory?
Right. Well, that's the whole point. Like, people said, sort of like remember what people said. People said, look, if you're being rational, you don't want to make enemies inside the government of people who, you know, are expert leakers and can do bad things. Now, they shouldn't. They should all be fired if they're leaking, you know, intelligence information that's very bad. And reporters aren't going to say it's bad. I mean, it's not bad for reporters to publish it if they get it, but it's bad for the people who are leaking it to leak it. It's not their property. They're leaking stolen property from the U.S. government. But people said, don't do this. What are you, crazy? Like, you don't want to make the FBI and the CIA your enemies and the DIA and the NSA. Like, what are you, nuts? You know, there's no reason to, you know, ignite this hostility toward you. But he did it anyway because he couldn't help himself. Well, because he's a paranoiac lunatic.
Right. Well, at the risk of being boring, I agree with you completely. Oh, I mean, God. Sorry. But the question is,
show a little spine, man.
Does he continue to do this and further embroil himself? He cannot conduct a presidency successfully and be sort of half at war with the intelligence community the whole time.
Okay. Well, this moves us to the next topic, which is, so he has what the polling now suggests is a reasonably successful foreign trip, despite everything. Okay, because his poll numbers were zooming down into the mid-30s, and all the polls show an uptick of a couple of points, 3 or 4 points, after 10 days abroad, 9 days abroad, whatever it was. So that's good news, right? It's great. Issues, you know, pushed people. The Pope wasn't smiling, and Michelle slapped his hand, and he danced with the orb, and, you know, whatever else, okay? So he comes back, and what happens? So Emmanuel Macron, the new president of France, said, you know, he tried to bully me, but I won't be bullied. And Angela Merkel, the premier of Germany, said, you know, obviously we're going to have to go it alone. That's Europe's now going to have to go it alone. So what does he do? Rather than just like let them vent, because he's the leader of the free world and the most powerful person on earth and all this. What does he do? He just goes at Merkel's jugular. Did it on Twitter in the last 2 days, said, you know, Germany's very bad. Germany's very bad, he said.
And the thing that makes absolutely no sense about that is that he could have spun this from his perspective as a victory. He's been saying that the U.S. is shouldering too much of the burden for Europe. He could have said, look, I came in here and now they're stepping up.
Well, he did say it, but then, you know, so there's this kind of elite European opinion which goes at his, you know, goes for him. And so he, in his classic Pavlovian response, you know, goes at them like an attack dog. And now we're going to have a week of him having a fight, you know, like having, you know, like going at Germany. Like what, how does that help him? He looked good because he was bestriding the narrow world like a colossus. And now he's like whining and complaining again.
My favorite part of all this, and we can unpack all the policy here, which we will, but my very favorite part is... Now, this first was dropped in a report in Bild, which is a German magazine, and people were like, well, this is kind of thinly sourced. It's very weird. It's based on translation engines. We should back off. And then Sean Spicer says, it didn't happen. There was no attack on Germany. Germany is not bad. He didn't say it was bad. He doesn't have a problem with the trade deficit. Relax, reporters. Trump comes out today on Twitter. Yes, Germany is bad. Trade deficit is awful. We're not going to let this stand. This happened to H.R. McMaster, who was forced to come out in front of this Russian intelligence revelation story, said it did not happen. Trump on Twitter 12 hours later. Yes, it did happen. The Rosenstein memo, the Comey firing.
Stein. Rosenstein.
Yeah, I thought it was Rosenstein.
It's no. Rosenstein.
Okay, Rosenstein.
We went through this last week. Rosenstein.
Regardless,
the
point is...
Think of young Frankenstein. It's not Frankenstein. It's Frankenstein. Rosenstein. It rhymes with Frankenstein.
Okay. We'll call him Frankenstein. In any case, the point is that nobody speaks for Trump but Trump, and everybody who does speak for Trump voluntarily or through conscription is eventually humiliated, and you should stop.
I think basically the whole point of this is that, you know, it's like people go, nah, I couldn't possibly mean that. He goes, yeah, I do. Sure I do. Now, by the way, it is a victory for Trump. Why? Because this is the whole policy of America First is actually being showing its full flowering as America First from the 30s onward, which is, you know, America's got no connections to any of these people. America's got no connection to anybody, like its allies. We're off on our own, and you can all go, you know, screw yourselves. And, you know, so what if you fought with us in Iraq and Afghanistan? So what if, you know, so what if you're standing? Granted, look, Merkel is a very problematic leader. She is, you know, arguably the person who is, you know, destroying whatever is left of great Europe because of her incredibly ill-advised open borders policy toward the Syrian refugees and all of that. Nonetheless, there's no reason not to be magnanimous. You know, and even if you're winning by saying, look, you know, I'm here asserting America's national interest, even in the face of our alliances. Our alliances, you could make this argument, our alliances don't mean that I, as president, don't have to look to the interests of the suffering guy in Ohio before I look to the interests of our connection in Brussels, you know, something like that. But that's all he's doing. He's just going, you all suck, and, you know, and stop being so sucky, or I don't care. And, you know, at least in Saudi Arabia, I get to dance with a knife and hold on to an orb. You know, they're great. I got no problem with them.
I mean, he's not above any spat or any fight. He will always get dragged down.
You know, it's
he's
like,
yet to take the high road.
Who is it? There's this famous, is it Rochefoucauld? There's some famous or diplomat, somebody who said famously of someone else, he's either at your feet or at your throat. Right? So the thing about Trump is that he goes into a lot of these meetings and these conversations with people and he flatters them outrageously. It's so fantastic. Such a beautiful, you know, you're so great. Come in. Let me show you. It's wonderful. And everything's great. You're so handsome. Your wife is pretty. And look at that gold lame. It's fantastic and all this. And that's one thing. And then the other is, you know, just annoy him a little bit. And then he just goes for your jugular like an attack dog. And he's got two modes, obsequiousness and slaughter or murder, and very little in the middle.
And yet I tend to think neither mode is sincere, actually. I mean, I think the attack mode is sincere to the extent that it's personal. But I don't – if tomorrow he came out and said, look, the great country of Germany, blah, 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 there are differences. But, you know, he could patch it up. I mean, not successfully, but he's not above trying to patch it up tomorrow and then reversing again the next day. I mean, I don't think there's any there on either end.
Well, I don't know. I think there's a there because I do think that there is something consistent and congruent. It's something that you say in your very fine piece, you know, is this the end of the free world in Commentary's June issue, which is that he is in a radically different way, but with some commonalities with Obama, he is more comfortable attacking allies than he is in confronting antagonists. And there is something in him that his idea is that America's traditional alliances have been harmful to us. And so he is the truth teller who's going to come in and say they're terrible. So he's going to say, Germany's bad. Our trade deficit is terrible. We don't have a trade deficit with Germany. Why would he assert that we have a trade deficit with Germany? Because he wants to divide the United States from Germany. That's an actual affirmative goal, and that is why it turns out that when we were all worried about what it meant that he was adopting the slogan of America First, we were not wrong to worry that this was isolationism. There are two forms of isolationism. There's political military isolationism and there's economic isolationism.
I'm inclined to agree that this is not sincere. The president just put pen to paper on a deal that does not discriminate against Chinese foreign direct investment into the United States. In Trump country, there are a lot of German manufacturers of automobiles that make automobiles here. From German firms. And I guarantee you they didn't hear this and they said, yeah, we need Germany out of America. That's where they get their paycheck. American elites who are interested in geopolitics are a little nervous about the fact that, well, this is sort of status quo effete liberal opinion in Europe, is that Europe needs to decouple itself from the United States and that Merkel has said something similar to this in the past. This isn't her modus operandi. She is not a skeptic of Western Atlanticism. In fact, she's been a big proponent of it. So to say that this is just sort of status quo campaign rhetoric is sort of underestimates, I think, the threat here. And I can't imagine what the constituency is for it. It's not for the internationalist elites that are suspicious of this. It's not for Republican stalwarts who are extroverted in terms of foreign policy. And it certainly has nothing to do with shoring up his base. So
why would you say that it's not genuine? So you're saying that it is genuine. In other words, if there's no good motive, why is he doing it if it's not genuine?
Well, it's sincere in the form that it's not going to result in any sort of policy.
Yeah, I think it's personal. I mean, I just think it's personal. I just think he can't let a slight go by.
Right? I don't know. Like, I just think why – it's not why would you pick a fight. He likes to pick fights. That's fine. I'm saying that there is something in him that says – that anything that was done before, that the status quo ante before him, including NATO, including, you know, having a good relationship with Merkel, even though she did something stupid on Syria, which means, you know, being both understanding that we need to have a relationship with China, but that we are somewhat adversarial with China. In certain cases, because we need to be militarily concerned about Chinese expansionism, in some ways more than we need to worry about, you know, China playing currency manipulation and screwing around with tariffs on its side while we don't have that many tariffs against them. But I think in the end, you know, there is something innate in him that seems to think that his great success would be to be able to go to the American people and say, I am so on your side that I'm not suckered in by all this talk about how we need to be friendly with Germany and England and France. What have they ever done for us? We sacrificed for them. They've done nothing for us. They're ingrates. You know, they're snooty. You know, they think they're better than we are. Well, they, you know, so let them see what it's like when they go it alone, as Merkel said. I don't even know what Merkel means by that, by the way. She was offended by him. Macron was offended by him. Everybody was, because he's offensive. He behaves right. Like a goon and a slob and a jerk. And like, this is the first time that, you know, we've ever seen an American president behave even remotely like this. But, you know, I mean, whatever, Obama was incredibly arrogant and was offensive to people for his arrogance, but not for his personal comportment.
It's like a Mark Twain story come to life, like yeah. This really boorish American caricature showing up in the steps of European parliaments and palaces.
And you got a lot. I mean, that's the thing. So he's like King Ralph or something like that. But it's so like that could be funny if it was if there were purposeful, or if he himself were able to have a sense of humor about it. It's like, I don't know, all this fancy with the but of course, what is it that he seeks to evoke with his ridiculous interior decorating style? He's not evoking the American prairie. He's not building Frank Lloyd Wright, you know, Shaker furniture there in Trump Tower. He's trying to make it look like a gilded palace out of, you know, central, you know, Mad King Ludwig's Mayerling.
Right, I mean,
that's what it's supposed to look like.
No, I mean, that was the remarkable thing is that on his trip abroad, you know, in terms of aesthetics, he was completely at home in Saudi Arabia and the Vatican.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, or so wannabe Vatican.
That's why it is personal, because he wants nothing more than to be accepted in these circles. That was the whole point of him being in politics in the first place, was to, you know, achieve this idea of himself that he's been unable to realize. And so he went to Europe expecting to be accepted as the American president, and is instead rejected as a clown and somebody who's dangerous to the geopolitical order. So he's offended by that.
Well,
he's hurt.
You know,
he's
hurt. He's very hurt. Well, you know, I was reminded of one thing, talking about like totally reductio ad absurdum here, but when he went through that crowd and pushed, who was it again? It was the Finnish
president? Macedonia.
The president of Macedonia out of the way so he could get to the front of the line. I was reminded of a moment on the playground. Not that I want to. It just wasn't about kids acting in the playground. It was parents in the playground.
Oh, I'm sorry. Montenegro.
Excuse me. Oh, that's right. So my daughter's like 3 years old. We're at the nearby playground, and there were a guy who lived in the apartment below me, who has since thankfully moved out. A very unpleasant person who had three kids of his own. So my daughter is in the park wearing a Winnie the Pooh T-shirt, and he's in the park with his kids, and his kids are doing something, and my daughter is standing there trying to get on a slide, and he's going somewhere, and this guy George walks up to my daughter and says, "Out of my way, Pooh." He was drunk, and he was sort of like, she was like standing. He was trying to reach his own kid like 5 feet away. He says, "Out of my way, Pooh." And I said, "George, what is the matter with you?" And he said, "What?" Like that. I said, "You talk that way to my 3-year-old?" And he's like, "I didn't say anything." This is a literal exchange that I had. So it's like, what are you going to believe? Me or your lying eyes or your ears or your face or something like that. There was something about that. Excuse me, I have to get to the front here, buddy. You know, it's bizarre.
The worst part of it is that, you know, for years, especially during the Bush years, everyone, liberal America, talked about what an embarrassment America now is on the world stage, what an embarrassment Bush is. And first of all, I don't feel that way about Bush. I don't feel that way about Bush's policies. But in general, I'm not susceptible to the argument that America ever has much to be embarrassed about when it comes to comparisons with Europe. I have to say the thing I cannot forgive Trump for is actually making me now sympathetic to that argument in this day and age.
It's been 60 years since, it's almost maybe 70 years since the publication of The Ugly American, which is a book which is not actually about what it sounds like it's about. It's a more complicated thing. But Trump, you know, if since that became the cliche of sort of boobish American, you know, barreling around the world vulgarly and be like, he has fulfilled this cliche at long last. In fact, Americans go around the world are very friendly, and you know, they don't know how to bargain, so they overpay for everything, and they're sort of gregarious and friendly. And they're, you know, this notion that they're so disgusting is just not true and not fair. But now it's fair,
right?
So, you know, that was a cliche that could have been basically retired, but it has been brought roaringly back to life, The Ugly American Abroad.
First made flesh, really.
Right. Now, having said that, I think we might want to spend a few minutes on the alt-history question of what would have happened had those 100,000 votes in those three states not gone the way that they went for Trump and made him president, and yet instead we were sitting here with Hillary Clinton. As president of the United States, there is this very big, juicy interview with her in New York Magazine by Rebecca Traister, story of what her life has been like since the election, the tragedy, horrors overtaken her, and the fact she had to do processing on the night of the, what was it, existential processing on the night of the election when it became clear that she was not going to be president. This interview, I think, as most of the literature, even the friendly literature that has been thrown Hillary's way since the election, makes it clear just what a horrendous candidate she was. And what if you are looking at this as somebody who voted for her, if you're listening and you're someone who voted for her, not, you may be kindly disposed toward her. You may think, oh, my God, I wish we had her now because of the horrors of Donald Trump and everything like that. Your attitude is false. You should be enraged. You should be furious with her. She blew this. She blew this from the outset. She still doesn't know why it happened. You know why she doesn't know why it happened? Because despite the fact that we've heard for 20 years she's so smart, she's like the classic dumb A student. She got A's because she figured out what professors wanted to hear. She figured out what her bosses wanted to hear. She figured out what, you know, certain types of people wanted to hear. And she figured out what the interest groups of the Democratic Party needed to hear from her. And the only person, the only people that she had literally no connection to, feel for, or a sense of how to lead, were the American people who didn't want her. Now, granted, she got more votes than Trump did, but, you know, that's not how we make these decisions. And, you know, this the question will be, will the Democratic Party, not from the standards she did this bad because she did this badly because she wasn't progressive enough, but from the, we really need to reckon with why it is that somebody lost and what it is that we need to do to find somebody who can make a connection. I think it's fair to say that the Republican Party after 2012, whatever happened after 2012, serious people in the Republican Party said, we need to understand why Mitt Romney lost. And we cannot be sentimental about how he's a good man and he was so closed his business to find a missing daughter and has a great family. And a lot of us feel very kindly disposed toward Mitt Romney, but he lost because he lost. And there was a reason why he lost and it had to be determined. And we still don't know whether that autopsy and all those theories were not right. Just because Trump won doesn't mean they were wrong. Having said that, like if the Democratic Party is going to deny itself the reckoning that it needs to understand why it drove itself down into this ditch, I think the Democratic Party is going to be in for a world of hurt in 2018, and America and the world are going to be in for a world of hurt in 2020. Noah?
Excuse me. I'm writing on this, just a little nugget in that interview right now, and it was the one that was focused on how aghast she was at the idea that there should be unbiased media coverage, because media coverage is itself biased by presenting the idea that there are two sides to every story as a legitimate notion. There are no two sides to every story. According to the progressive ethos that Hillary Clinton is now channeling, there is only one side to certain stories, the progressive side. And to that end, she marveled at the idea that MSNBC would hire George Will as a a commentator, and that the New York Times would hire Bret Stephens as a columnist because they challenge progressive worldviews. Why would they do that? She marveled. Not because she thinks that, but because she thinks that's what progressives want to hear. She's been masterfully emotionally manipulative of Democrats since she lost this thing by blaming everything from media, myopia, and moderators, and the Russia stuff, and Jim Comey, and of course American misogyny for her loss. She's just channeling all these things that just tap into the, what progressives want to believe. And so she is sort of seeking exculpation and finding it in a way by channeling all these other issues that progressives want to focus on, even at their own detriment. None of that is healthy. No honest progressive will say this kind of retreat into these ideologically homogenous bubbles is good for you. It's just something they want to do. They're indulging their id, and Hillary's just going right ahead with it, giving them permission to do that because it helps her out politically.
But she's only manipulating that segment of the left that is already putty in her hands. I mean,
but you know, I think they have control of the conversation.
But I don't know if they're putty in her hands. Like, the Sanders people have real reason to, you know, remember Sanders won 22 states. Like, you know, this is no joke.
Oh, that's
this
what I mean. Not, they're right? outside that segment.
They're the outside Sanders that segment. Right. Now, yeah. By the way, I just also want to point out that Brett voted for Hillary. So it's really nice.
He said that. He was wounded.
Okay. It's really nice of her to say, why would you hire him, the guy who spent 26, you know, almost a year savaging Trump on the pages of the Wall Street Journal, in her sort of essentially implicitly helping her and then voting for her, and right. George Will doing the same, George Will said he was no longer a Republican because Donald Trump was the nominee of the Republican Party. These are the two people that she attacks. This, again, is a sign of her lack of emotional intelligence. That was the wrong thing to, I don't care if it was sounded good, it was like a nice, lovely thing to, you know, melt into Rebecca Traister's idiot ear, but it was not, because the simple fact of the matter is you don't attack people who voted for you. Fine, 65 million people voted for her. You don't attack somebody who voted for you, who did so, by the way, at some risk to his professional reputation, his own base. His base. He has a base. He was a conservative columnist with a base, and he went at Trump and voted for her, and this is the way she behaves.
But, you know, this is a problem that is, you see it all across the liberal and left part of the political spectrum, which is that they tend not to think that they need to make arguments for their positions. I mean, right. Barack Obama had this too. He treated everything he wanted to do as the obvious common sense choice. That this is not the way, and Republicans, conservatives tend not to be that way. I mean, some are, of course. But
plenty are. And, you know, we've done nothing but attack those people ourselves for 2 years. Not that Hillary Clinton would be at all praising of that, you know, because the truth is that there's an immense amount of heterodoxy on the right, whatever you want to consider intellectual heterodoxy, against the leadership of the nominal leadership of the Republican Party in 2017. And I don't see much heterodoxy on the left.
Well, in this particular case, there is. There are people like Cory Booker who's saying, I'm not going to indulge your impeachment fantasies. There are people like Tim Ryan who is saying, I can't convince Democrats of how unpopular my party is in the places that we need to win. They don't want to hear it. And that sort of stuff is bubbling up. It's not getting a lot of purchase because Democrats don't want to hear that they're wrong. But some people are saying it to their credit.
That's true, although Cory Booker's political career is partly owed, you know, got a lot of money from the Kushner family.
I think it says quite a bit that a man of such naked ambition as Cory Booker would refuse to indulge this fantasy on the left of impeachment.
Fair enough, fair enough. But, I mean, I don't know that there's an equivalency there. I mean, there's a book coming out by Patricia Williams, a famous gender studies scholar, called White Working Class, that in fact does seem to make the case that she, you know, wanders around and all she hears are her fellow progressives, you know, downgrading, insulting, and depersonalizing the members of the white working class who formed the heart of the Democratic base for 70 years, or actually more like 50 years, let's say, or 40 years, but were the focus of the Democratic base of the, you know, in the United States, and that now because the Democratic Party more explicitly associates with new class aspirationalism, environmentalism, feminism, LGBTQ XY issues. I can't remember what the sequence of the letters are there. You know, and all gender politics and identity politics and all that, that, you know, this then inclines them to treat with hostility the people who nominally, you know, their solutions for economic equity and all that are supposed to help. So that it's not that there isn't some thinking going on. It's just that, you know, you sort of default to, oh, poor Hillary, you know, this cup was stolen from her lips by, you know, depredacious forces, as opposed to saying, what did you do to us? We're sitting here with Donald Trump as president because you stank. You set up a server. You lied about it. You lied about it for 18. You couldn't even talk to the press. And you let him, you know, you let him make you appear weak and criminal. And that's because you were weak and you looked criminal.
And you offered no core message.
No
reason.
Yeah, right. So, and, you know, the question is, will the core reason of the Democratic Party simply be that Trump is too evil to allow to govern? And then that goes to the question of whether 2018, as both Ben Domenech on the right and David Ignatius on the center left are saying, Democrats are going to run 2018 as an impeachment election, i.e., win us the House and we will impeach him. Impeachment is a simple majority vote of the House. And so if Democrats get the majority in the House, they can impeach Trump. I mean, they can do it. You know, the first thing that they do when they take the gavel, there are two possibilities there. One of which is this will be a very successful message. It'll raise them hundreds of millions of dollars and they will recruit decent candidates and slam him. And then the last 2 years of Trump's first term will be about impeachment. And the other is that they will awaken the sleeping giant of Trumpism and midterm, and the midterms will be a lot closer than people expect. I have no idea which way that goes. Noah, you like to predict things.
I do.
Well, you like to. Maybe you're feeling a little.
I regret them.
I regret what I had for breakfast this morning. So I, you know.
Well, I actually have a thought on it. I mean, I think the impeachment thing is a winner in terms of fundraising because there are a lot of people out there who want that as an actual sort of political goal to run on. I think it's less viable.
If I were going to say anything at this early stage, I would say that Democrats could put a whole bunch of crash test dummies up against Republicans and they would benefit from a swing in the political pendulum. There has been only one midterm election this century where the White House has not taken a bath, and it was in 2002. So,
and that was after 9/11.
So I am anticipating Republicans will lose seats, whether they lose 23 seats.
23 seats would be on the very, very, very low end of – I mean, you know, we're talking about swings of – there was 34 in 2006, mm-hmm. 63 in 2010, 9 Senate seats in 2014, 52 seats in 1994. I mean, these swings, if they swing, they swing big. Now, you still have to have candidates in these seats, and a lot of those numbers were racked up not 2010, but sort of before that were racked up before – the real conclusion of the famous Big Sort, in which, you know, people really are now living in physical proximity to people that they are ideologically attuned to. And so it's not so easy, like a Trump district where Trump wins by 10 and not by 5, you know. So though there are 23 districts in the United States that Trump won, or Hillary won with a Republican in the House. So, you know, they're vulnerable, and if impeachment is the sole goal to save America, it is at least a honed message and a national message. And the whole notion is, you know, having a national message benefits the party with a national message in a wave election because it increases the size of the wave. Or that's the theory. Now every election is different. And we have no idea. But, you know, he's got to get better at this and fast. We also have the phenomenon that, you know, obviously he's going to get nothing, right? He's not going to get health care. He's not going to get a tax cut. Unlikely he's going to get a tax cut, I think. So he's going to go into.
Tax cut is what they're going to settle on. You don't think they're going to get anything by 2018?
Where are they going to get the money for a tax cut if they don't have 120 or 130, 150?
Well, healthcare's got to pass.
Right. So healthcare's not going to pass. So where are they going to get the tax cut? okay, healthcare is a full of tax cuts, but I mean the tax cut itself, if they have to do it with reconciliation, if the Democrats decide on an impeachment strategy, they are not going to let him win anything. So they have to do it through reconciliation. Reconciliation, everything in reconciliation has to be paid for. So a tax cut has to be revenue neutral. The only way it can be revenue neutral is if you get savings from the healthcare bill. The healthcare bill isn't even that big, the savings. It's like $190 billion. That's not a big tax cut, although it sounds big, but it's not, in fact. So he may be going into 2018 with no legislative victories.
And then
it's just a cultural election. Then it literally is just, are you going to let them do this to him? Or, are you going to let the Democrats and the fake media and everything like that, are you going to let them overturn the results of an election?
I was about to ask what would be the rallying cry, and I guess that's it. It's unsatisfying from my perspective, but I guess it's enough to get some people out of bed.
Well, save Clinton. I mean, in other words, in 1998, if Clinton hadn't successfully marshaled the idea that the impeachment of Bill Clinton for his behavior in the Oval Office was a way that the evil Republicans were going to, overturn the will of the majority through a culture war puritanism about his sexual peccadilloes. But if he had been more circumspect, more guilty, more nervous, all of that, things could have gone the other way. I mean, Joe Lieberman voted, got up and said Bill Clinton should be censured by the Senate. Like that was the censure of the Senate was the lesser of the options than impeachment. That's why he was offering it. But if people had been saying that in February, like that his behavior was beyond the pale, who knows if he would have survived it. So it helps to say, this something evil is going on here. They're trying to overturn the results of an election. It could stimulate a lot of voters. But
boy, oh boy, would it take us down the road of the Banana Republic. I mean, to have
well,
it.
Well, we are. In, look,
I know. But
well,
to,
look,
but to
it's
have
not
the election
like we're not 20 miles down that 100-mile road already, right?
Right. But, election that's between a cult and the anti-cult and, the,
I mean, look,
just to
make it clear, it's like you said, oh, it's so terrible and, you never Trumpers. I'm not, in fact, a never Trumper. But, blah, 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 right? But, the guy is in the Oval Office and his son-in-law is going around making private deals with the Russians and he's got his daughter and his son-in-law is his closest advisors with offices when they're not like traipsing around to Vail and taking pictures on Instagram of their skiing trip. That's Banana Republic stuff. That is not, that is not well within the American tradition.
Well, we can all look forward to Zuckerberg versus The Rock in 2020.
Yeah, well, really? Who's running in
which
party?
Well, The Rock primary is Donald Trump.
Okay,
and
Noah, you,
Zuckerberg,
I believe, were the one.
Promises
I believe,
everybody free money.
I believe we can say without fear of contradiction that what glimpse we got of Mark Zuckerberg's oration at Harvard last week would not incline one to believe that he is the.
He's not an inspiring public speaker, but he's literally promising everyone free money. I don't think that fails.
Okay,
free money for everybody. Vote for me. You wouldn't? You say yes. Free money.
Okay.
Everybody deserves free money.
Well, anyone can do that. Oprah can promise
Precisely.
Free money. Oprah would be better than Zuckerberg if that's where you're going. If Zuckerberg's in, Oprah better get in. That's all I can say because,
The good news is we have free money coming our way.
The only really good thing about Zuckerberg becoming president, it would be another stick in the eye of Aaron Sorkin, right, who wrote the whole movie, wrote The Social Network, the whole theme of The Social Network being, he's such a jerk. What a jerk. Can you believe this guy? He's an incredible jerk. It's like another effort to, save America from Aaron Sorkin would go down the tubes if Mark Zuckerberg became president.
It would
president,
probably be the best thing that could ever happen to him.
To who? To Aaron Sorkin? Why?
And Jesse Eisenberg. Because they would have work for 4.5 years.
Oh, you mean like they would run the president show? The president show on Comedy Central, where Donald Trump hosts a talk show, could now be the Jesse Eisenberg president show.
Right.
Okay. Well, lot as we go down the road to Idiocracy, there are many twists and turns. So, Idiocracy, the Mike Judge movie, go rent it. It's amazing. And it does, in fact, foretell everything that is going on. And it was made 12 years ago, and it made $400,000 at the box office for good reason, which is that America couldn't stand the vision of the future that it was so accurately portraying. Anyway, so that brings us to a close of another exciting, happy, optimistic, and forward-looking Commentary Magazine podcast. Go to commentarymagazine.com. Few free reads. Read Noah Rothman's How to Be a Conservative in the Age of Trump. Abe Greenwald's Is This the End of the Free World? John Podhoretz's essay on podcasting. What else do we have in that issue? That
Stephen Daisley on Theresa May.
The not-so-darling buzz of Theresa May. And this is a piece that was filed before Theresa May's incredibly self-destructive publication of the manifesto that seems to have turned a runaway landslide election into something that's much closer and will do her more injury. But it's very predictive of exactly what happened. So give it a read, commentarymagazine.com, Noah Rothman Daily Comment, the Daily Commentary by Noah Rothman and Max Boot and Michael Rubin and me occasionally and Evelyn Gordon and a bunch of other very, very sound, Jonathan Marks, but very sound, interesting people. And we are putting together a great symposium for the summer on the threat to free speech, which will be out in a couple weeks. So come back. Go to iTunes, leave us a really good review. You know you're supposed to do it. Was it going to kill you? Wouldn't your mother tell you to do it if you're enjoying this content for free? It's just, it's not even a pledge drive. We're not even asking for money. Just saying go leave a review. That's all we're saying. So go do it or I'm going to feel very, 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 very put out with you. That's all I'm saying. I don't know who you are, but I'm very put out with you. Or I'm happy with you. And Noah and Abe are both extremely put out with me. So thanks very much. Keep the candle burning.